So it was during the hot and humid rainy season of 1943 that the Provincial Commission of Ndola vented his frustration in a letter to the Chief Secretary of the Colonial Government of Northern Rhodesia, which is now the Zambia. I'd like to actually show you a slide. Yeah. He wrote, "The habit of changing name on every possible occasion is becoming an absolute pest, and is against the best interest of the Africans themselves. It is sometimes done because the owner thinks he may wish sometime or other to cover up his tracks. I'm particularly keen on devising some system of establishing identity a part of the pass law, but I should like it to be uniform for the territory." Of course, when changing one's name in a context of taxation, exploitative labor migration, and forced labor, whether changing one's name in a context of taxation, exploitative labor migration, and forced labor is in the best interest of the Africans themselves is a matter of debate, to say the least. What the provincial commissioner referred to in his letter was the great difficulty faced by the colonial administration in making the different types of written registration and identification compatible with each other. In other words, the colonial administrators in Northern Rhodesia, the troublesome challenge was to permanently make stick one name and one name only to a given person. When confronted with the subversive strategies of Africans to evade entanglements in the emergent bureaucratic system, colonial administrators came up with creative solutions. And some of them even posed as ardent defenders of African tradition. In a follow-up to the letter by the provincial commissioner of Ndola, his colleague from Central Province gave an example of this habit of changing names. There's a growing tendency on the part of modern youth to drop the childhood name, which tendency I consider should not be encouraged. For instance, a man called John Chisenga has a son who is given the birth name of Kalunga. As a youth, Kalunga adopts the name of Isaac. His full name should be Isaac Kalunga Chisenga, but he thinks it grand to call himself Isaac John, and he probably becomes registered as such. Inevitably, if this trend is allowed to become general, Africa will be peopled by bicycle, ticket, football, and native names will be forgotten. It would be a tragedy if such actually happened. I consider it would be an excellent thing if all clerks engaged in the work of registering would be instructed not to accept such names as Isaac John when forwarding applications for identity certificates. Ironically, administrative necessities were here suggested restricting the cultural hybridity that prevailed in the newly established industrial areas in the colony in order to retrieve an African identity. Unequivocal and authentic African names appear to guarantee a similarly unequivocal bureaucratic colonial type of registration. Similar to what Gert Spittler already in the 70s has described for the colonial bureaucracy in French West Africa, the administration in Northern Rhodesia thus faced difficulties in bureaucratically inscribing subjects into existing power relations. They failed to inscribe clearly identifiable subjects into what Michel Foucault has aptly called networks of writing. This network engages people in a whole mass of documentic, bureaucratic inscriptions that capture and fix them, entangling their lives in documents that are systematically connected with each other. For instance, people living in Germany in this audience are familiar with the fact that legalized labor in this country requires an income tax card. Yet these cards can only be obtained if there's official documentation of one's place of residence, which in turn presupposes an identity card, and so on. Networks of writing like these make sure that people in Germany find it exceedingly difficult to evade the grip of the state, should they wish to do so. But there are also other reasons for why bureaucracy is often said to be endowed with powerful agency. Among many other things, bureaucracy is about means, ends, rationality, formalization and normalization. It subdues people's identities in everyday lives into grids of classification that erase specificities and idiosyncrasies. The bureaucrat, on the other hand, does not really speak for himself or herself, but acts in the name of a higher order, which allows the bureaucrat to deflect personal responsibility and remain indifferent towards what is administered by him or her, even if this means exercising some form of structural violence. Yet, while all of this can be said to be true, in many or even most instances, there's also another side to the picture. For example, in the recent past, anthropologists have increasingly become aware of the fact that bureaucratic practices are not just enacted by representatives of the state, with citizens and subaltern populations always and necessarily on the receiving side. Instead, in many parts of the present-day world, bureaucratization has reached almost all areas of social life, including fields of activity that aim at counteracting a hegemonic state. Craig Hetherington has recently shown how peasant activists in Paraguay have adopted bureaucratic ways of arguing when engaging in land politics, thus making bureaucracy a weapon against the state. Also, my own research in Zambia and South Africa provides evidence for the existence of bureaucracy in areas of life where one would least expect them, namely in spirit-led charismatic movements, as well as among vigilante groups that are usually associated with spontaneous mob violence. What is more and most important for the topic of this plenary session, characterizing bureaucracy as an all-powerful apparatus that petrifies the world by reducing its ambiguities, contradictions, and flux, would only tell half of the story. Like it or not, street-level bureaucracy is also a site of creativity that provides social actors with discursive and practical registers to navigate the world. I have no doubt that all of us have some experience of encounters with bureaucrats where a discretionary leeway and social negotiability eventually prevailed over bureaucratic standards. My personal experience in this regard was a policeman in Berlin who actually co-authored a crime witness report with me, telling me exactly what statement from my side would lead to what specific criminal charge by prosecutors and allowing me to change my statement accordingly. It is a really great pleasure for me to welcome the speakers of our plenary session, all of whom have made important contributions to the anthropology of bureaucracy. Our first speaker, Matthew Hull, from the University of Michigan, has become one of the most prominent protagonists in this field of study. Among his publications are the book Government of Paper, The Materiality of Bureaucracy in Urban Pakistan, as well as an extended review article entitled Documents and Bureaucracy, published in the Annual Review of Anthropology in 2012. The second speaker, here in the middle, Colin Hope, teaches anthropology at Smith College is very well known for his work on the immigration bureaucracy in South Africa, where he explored the ambiguous condition of hope and despair experienced by people engaged in bureaucratic counters, as well as the technologies that produce and manage this ambiguity. Also, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome legal anthropologist Mia Halmetur-Mosari from the Helsinki Collegium of Advanced Studies, who is presently engaged in a fascinating project on the UN Human Rights Commission that addresses many of the issues discussed in this plenary session. So I'm looking forward to the paper. Welcome again, and the floor is your back.
Some of you might have noticed my paper is entirely different from the one that I proposed and is listed in the program. Apologies to any of you who come here looking forward to my original paper, but trust me, you'll like this one better. So I might be accused of taking the conference theme too literally. I'm going to discuss the actual ends of negotiation between people like this, and also people like this. The people on the left are staff of Zakitza Healthcare Limited, working at a corporate call center in Indian state of Punjab. The people on the right are the Punjab police. They work with on the 181 Punjab police helpline. I'm going to be talking about how they end their negotiations about closing complaint cases and what this tells us. Starting in 2013, the helpline was intended to solve the most commonplace problems of traditional bureaucracies: access and inaction. Instead of being run by the police, management and staffing of the call center operations had been contracted to a private corporation. The corporate police arrangement raises a range of fascinating issues regarding gender, software and databases, popular understandings of police, and changes in what we might call the business model of police stations. However, in this talk, I'm going to focus on how negotiations about closing complaint cases are partly about the way citizens are figured in relation to police procedures. The integration of corporate call center customer service practices into the Indian police procedures creates a tension between two different forms of human and technological mediation. This tension is at the same time a tension between two conceptualizations of a political subject. First, the codified in the law of police procedure requires that a person be represented by an authoritative person. And second, embedded in customer service practices, the second notion requires that a person represent him or herself, that is, with minimal agential involvement of another person. As I'll show, this tension is manifested most directly in disputes between the corporation staff and police about closing cases. Initially, the 181 helpline was designed for women to help them with non-emergency matters. The Punjab Police Call Center was to address two problems facing women who needed police. First, accessing police personnel, and second, persuading them to take their complaints seriously and pursue them. In India, women find it especially difficult to have their complaints officially recorded in what is known as an FIR, or First Information Report. This is a document that sets the process of criminal justice in motion. Women's movement outside the home and immediate neighborhood, especially in rural areas, is often restricted, and many lack the means to get to a police station. Beyond these challenges, many women are reluctant to appear in police stations as these are morally fraught, even dangerous places, and few women are willing to go to one without a male relative, often to protect them from the police themselves. The problem of inaction is even more complex. State organizations are so closely associated with documentation that it's often forgotten that many functionaries, for any number of reasons, often refuse to generate documents. In India, one of the major problems with police is that they regularly refuse to register complaints and initiate proceedings. This is a particular problem for women. Even when a woman goes to a police station, their claims are sometimes dismissed. Sometimes police, usually men, but often women as well, reject the standing of women to act for themselves and demand that they be represented by a male relative who is often akin of the perpetrator if he is not the perpetrator himself. More broadly, police are often unwilling to get involved in domestic abuse cases, which police often find very messy, if not unworthy of their attention. And this is something actually we find around the world, certainly in the US as well. 181 helpline procedures were designed to ensure police would initiate proceedings, that is, produce a document for every complaint within specified time limits. The system eventually expanded to include other vulnerable populations, including children, elderly, and non-resident Indians, and it now serves the entire population of the state. Some 60% of the calls have nothing to do with these vulnerable populations. All right, so how does the system work? It's an adaptation of the discourses, technologies, and practices of customer service pioneered in the US telecom and banking systems. The core staff is a group of so-called call takers, usually around 10 on duty during the day. Through a series of exchanges with the caller, a call taker gradually assembles a case on her screen, hopscotching around the screen between checkboxes, drop-down menus for things like police station, type of victim, and type of complaint. It's important to note that the call takers are not permitted to refuse to make a record. All phone calls are recorded and also archived. When the record is saved, the complaint is, as they put it, registered, given a case number consisting of a unique 6-digit number. This is like a flight confirmation number. And the caller can reference the case in future dealings with the helpline or even directly with the police. The record produced by the helpline thus functions as a preliminary first information report. That is, it's a database record that initiates the process to produce an official paper document, which is supposed to initiate formal police inquiry. The case is then tagged with a color code, depending on the urgency, the temporal frame in which it has to be dealt with, and importance, the seriousness of the issue. Each code has a corresponding so-called turnaround time, and the police have to deal with these cases within these time limits. The actions of the call center are designed to force the police to produce a paper document within the designated turnaround time, a so-called action taken report, or ATR. The first information report, the document that initiates police investigation, is defined in the Indian Code of Criminal Procedure. By contrast, the action taken report is a document genre drawn from worldwide customer service practices. It is codified not by statute, but by helpline procedures, and is a KITSA software that encodes them. 181 staff track turnaround times for particular cases and inform police when the deadline for sending the action taken report has not been met. Following the submission of the action taken report, 181 staff call back the caller to verify the police account given in the action taken report and determine, and here's the odd part, to determine if the caller is satisfied, a process I'll describe more fully below. The tension between customer service and police legal conceptualizations of the role of citizens in police procedure are especially evident at two points in the handling of a case: the registration of a complaint and the documentation of the caller's satisfaction. First, the registration of complaints. This is a bit of diversion from negotiations, but it clearly, as we'll see, shows what's at stake in the negotiations. Audio recordings and database text record of complaints have only some of the features of written police records and an entirely different structure of human participation. Nevertheless, the composite records generated by the call takers through corporate customer service software form the basis of quasi-official police proceedings. One police official who was very unhappy with this system argued to me that 181 documentary practices clash with the Code of Criminal Procedure, the 1973 law covering the procedure for administering criminal law in India. He pulled out his copy of the code and pointed to section 154, which actually this is the action taken report where they have to say what they've done. I apologize for that. And this is the section 154, which lays out the law governing documentation and registration of complaints, commonly called the first information report. First, he emphasized to this officer that oral complaints had to be reduced to writing, and he told me it wasn't clear that the records 181 was generating are writing at all. He was skeptical that entries in an electronic database could count as writing under the law. Second, callers provided no verifiable identification of themselves, and their oral assent to the complaint description read back to them by call takers was no substitute for the signature required on an FIR. But for him, the bigger problem is that the KITSA call takers are not police officers with legal authority to accept a complaint. It's important to note that under the code, the role of the police officer is not to affirm the accuracy of complainants' claims, but simply to authorize them as having been made, to represent the complainant to the criminal justice system. So KITSA call takers could be seen to play a similar role, talking to the caller, constructing a complaint record, and passing it on to the police. But this, the officer argued, is precisely the problem. Since the KITS employees had no status as officials in the criminal justice system, the 181 system was in effect allowing callers to bypass or even usurp the authority of police and to represent themselves, pushing their complaints directly into police procedure. The 181 system enables complainants to set police procedures in motion without the exercise of police authority. And this relates to the second part where the tension between police procedure and customer service comes out, and that is the relative value of written and oral expressions. And this comes out particularly clearly in the documentation and negotiation of satisfaction. After receiving an action taken report, case coordinators call back the original caller to determine whether he or she is satisfied or not satisfied with police action. As the voluminous literature and consumer surveys suggest, determining satisfaction of an individual with respect to something is accepted to be a complex task. It's akin to the problems of determining any opinion, which, like satisfaction, is conceptualized as an irreducibly subjective, even interior fact. In customer service practice, satisfaction is constructed as a mental state in relation to some expectation. Inquiries about caller satisfaction often disclose facts about police action, but they are meant to learn about the feelings of complainants. As a psychological fact, the complainant's own utterances provide the only evidence for satisfaction that is authorized by call center procedures. Case coordinators call back many times if they have to in order to reach the original complainant. They will not accept the testimony of anyone else, be they the complainant's husband, wife, son, father, mother, sister, or children, since that person might willfully or unintentionally provide a false account. Call center staff are trained to be attuned to the emotional qualities of social complexity and social complexity of phone interactions. However, the determination of satisfaction as a bureaucratic object puts an overwhelming emphasis on the propositional content of a complainant's speech rather than its tone or other aspects which might provide evidence for a more subjective inference about satisfaction. This insistence on the propositional content of utterances reflects the awkward legalization of satisfaction. Case coordinators begin by informing the complainant what the action taken report said and asking if it's accurate. If the action taken report claims that the complainant was satisfied, then the case coordinators usually settle the question of satisfaction by a direct query. Is it true? Are you satisfied or not? And you would use, in this case, one or another version of a Hindi or Punjabi word for satisfied or agreeable or happy even. If the action taken report makes no such claim, the case coordinator starts a more open-ended conversation about police doings. They ask about the manner of police, what official actions police took, recording a statement, giving them documents, taking information, photos, and so forth. Lastly, they ask if the police committed any offense, such as threatening them, demanding a bribe, or beating them. Such questions serve a couple functions. First, they engender in the caller what the police and call center consider legitimate expectations of the police. Second, they frame the issue of satisfaction in relation to police procedure, police service and procedure, rather than events themselves in the larger socio-political situation. Absent a framing discussion, a question to someone who has just been beaten, had something valuable stolen, or lost a family member, the complainant would find a question about satisfaction absurd, if not outrageous. Given the level of distrust and fear of the police, we could find it surprising that as many as 35% of complainants in some districts are willing to express dissatisfaction. Many complainants report not being satisfied for reasons that have little to do with police wrongdoing. Police explain to me that it is not possible to, quote, get 100% satisfied. And here's another quote, because they want police to do things they can't do. They want a good postman. They want the stagnant water taken care of. One police officer told me that this was a great problem for police, especially when 181 had just started. He said, quote, people had feeling that anything can be done through 181 since it has to please me, unquote. Throughout the state, complainants report not being satisfied because someone is not keeping terms of the compromise brokered by the police. And I'll just move that back for a second. Here's this ATR. The compromises are often part of the action taken reports. As one policeman told me, the fights start up after compromises. Some people are not satisfied with the bargains they strike. But complainants also dispute the claims of police action taken reports. This is an entry from 2016. Callers disagree with ATR due to police has not initiated any action or case, hence case is closed and is tagged as totally dissatisfied. Callers also tell case coordinators that police are impolite, do not provide required documents, will not return stolen property they recover, demand bribes, steal from complainants, threaten violence, and even beat them up. But the most common reason for dissatisfaction is that complainants won't limit their expectations to dignity and adherence to legal procedure. They demand actions that police won't or can't take, such as a summary arrest of an accused person. Such grievances are so common that case coordinators keep the following phrases in a text window to copy and paste into records. According to the complainant, no action has been taken by police. Or another one, but police has not initiated any action against the accused. As case coordinators sometimes more forthrightly document, quote, the complainant wants justice, unquote. Such responses raise many questions about what justice is for them and what they expect of the police. But in this short presentation, I'm going to focus on the negotiations between case coordinators and police. Here's an actual transcript of, this is a translation of a Punjabi Hindi language exchange between a case coordinator and police negotiating the satisfaction of various callers. I'm not going to go through, but you can see that the numbers turn into the cases and people trade. And what's important is that these negotiations go on constantly, and the police are trying to get the satisfaction of people because this matters for their reputations and their relationship with their bosses. And case coordinators are often telling that people are not satisfied. And police return to the people after and try to get them to be satisfied as well. So police responding to complaints have increasingly tried to expedite the process of producing bureaucratically recognized signs of satisfaction by dealing with it from the start. Police increasingly ask 181 callers to sign affidavits that they are, quote, satisfied in an effort to buttress their action taken reports. The head of one rural district told me that police in his district ask complainants to sign statements that they are satisfied according to the law. That's a quote. But reports confirm this observation, his observation that they often become not satisfied when they don't see action on their cases. Many other police don't bother with actual statements. They simply get them to sign a blank piece of paper on which they later inscribe wholehearted and enthusiastic declarations of satisfaction. But written and signed statements and action taken reports can't stand against the follow-up interviews by case coordinators, and this is the key for the negotiation part. While police oriented to law work through the written record, the call center privileges spoken word. In legal proceedings, prior written declarations weigh very heavily against a person's later statements that contradict them. In contrast, case coordinators' staff take the oral word of the complainant regarding satisfaction when they talk to them over any prior written declarations. Satisfaction can change. Police are made to answer for subsequent oral self-representations of callers as mediated by the records of the call center, of course. So let me conclude briefly. We can view the 181 arrangement as the integration of a state agency and a private corporation. But other things come into view when we treat them as two kinds of bureaucracies. So we have negotiations between bureaucracies and not, as was more typical, between bureaucracies and the people they deal with. In the negotiations over closing complaint cases, we can see the integration and tension between, on the one hand, an older governmental bureaucratic model that vests power in the written word of officials, and on the other, a newer corporate bureaucratic customer service model that vests power in the oral word of the customer. These negotiations also figure different kinds of political subjects. While the first demands that individual utterances be represented by someone else, the second conjures the autonomous individual whose own utterances represent her. Let me end on a hopeful note, if not quite an optimistic one. I focused on routine closings, but we need to recognize this singular opening. Corporations and digital systems, as we heard in Ursula Rao's talk yesterday, are often rightly associated with attempts to eliminate negotiations. In the case of the call center, the corporate call digital system was established